So yeah, sensitive topic, obviously. My problem is I teach on this a lot in a lot of different venues, and so I've lost my sensitivity to it. So I'll try to guard my language and my thoughts. But nevertheless, it is an important aspect of marriage when it comes to your sexual relationship, physical intimacy in marriage. As your notes say, it's an abused topic for a couple of different reasons. Just where people have formed their growing up, form their views about this, they carry that into marriage. So we want to essentially rescue this word because there's a couple of extremes that have resulted. One extreme, even in the church world, the Christian world, certainly in the lost world, is it's considered the most important and the greatest aspect of marriage. This is what marriage is all about. And the idea is that if you have a good sexual relationship, then you'll have a good marriage. That's sort of the way the world looks at it. And some Christians have bought into that as well. There was a famous book, a Christian book, it's still in the market out there, called, I think it was written by Tim LaHaye. And the title of the book, it was in the 70s, I remember it was like the only book, a Christian book on it, but it was called The Act of Marriage. And you sort of exegete that title, I'm sure he doesn't mean this, but some look at that and go, the act of marriage. I mean, this is what marriage is about. So that's a little extreme to say that if you have a good sexual life, then that's the key to a good marriage, a good sex life. On the other hand, the other extreme is whatever you do, don't talk about this, don't think about it, don't bring it up in the church of all places, don't talk about it there, don't even bring it up in the home. The problem with that view is that ignores the fact that the Bible does address this. God does have a plan for sexual relations in marriage. That view would ignore all the scriptures that touch on this topic. It kind of gives the impression that God has no opinion, He's silent on it, that He has no guidelines, He has no answers for sexual problems. And the result of those two extremes then is sometimes couples have problems in this area of their relationship. And I'm not talking about physical problems that can be solved, by talking to a physician and seeing what's going on and so on and so forth. I'm talking about just problems in their relationship. And so it does come up in counseling. It will be a topic in counseling at times. Even believers who are struggling with this end up being unhappy, and so they get involved in some relationship outside their marriage, thinking that's the answer, which means they're solving their problems no better than unbelievers are doing. Or if they don't do that, most don't do that, but still they're unhappy. So they're just living in a marriage and there's conflict over this part of their marriage. And that happens a lot. The conflict over how the husband and wife are seeing this differently, they're approaching it differently, and they don't go outside the marriage to solve their problems, but they're just living with these unsolved sexual conflicts. And attempts to ignore it, those are unsuccessful. Attempts to solve the problems, they don't know how to solve them, there's no solutions. And so what I'm describing, it happens in Christians' homes. Christians, pastors, missionaries, doesn't matter, leaders, and it's all unnecessary. So our goal tonight is to aggressively rescue this word from all the misuse and look at the general guidelines that we find in Scripture that touch on this topic. Before I get into these guidelines, there's about six of them, I think, general guidelines. Keep one thing in mind, that the overall purpose of every aspect of marriage is the glory of God. 1 Corinthians 10:31, whatever you do, do to the glory of God. That's true about this topic as well, every aspect of your marriage. Ultimately, sex is ultimately for the glory of God. So just keep that in mind as we go forward here. Let me jump over a bunch of stuff here just a moment. And one other thought, keep in mind, obviously we believe this, that sex is blessed by God, it's allowed by God, and to be enjoyed only within the boundary of marriage. And marriage exists for the glory of God, so therefore this exists for the glory of God. So here are the practical sort of guidelines, implications on this topic. Let's start with this one, God's view of sex, and that is that it is something pure, it is something holy. How do we know that? Well, first of all, because sex was created by God before the fall, before sin entered the world. Just go back in your mind to the days of creations, day 3, 4, and 5. What did God say after each day of those days about his work? He said it was what? It was good. Then on the sixth day, he created human beings, not just human beings. He created sexual human beings, a man and a woman. There were differences based on their gender. There was differences based on their sexuality. There was male and female. He created them. And he created both in his image. So there's something about being a male, there's something about being female that reflects something about God, but there obviously are inherent differences between the two, much more than just their physical bodies. Differences there as well, obviously. But and what's God's attitude about that? What did he say after day six? Everything he created was very good. There's that added modifier, very good. So they were sexual human beings. He gave them the blessing to multiply, okay? So they're sexual human beings. So we can conclude that sex was ordained by God before the fall. To say it negatively, sex in marriage is not designed merely to just be the outlet for sinful passions. That's not what it is. And it is still called honorable after the fall. And you jump all the way to Hebrews 13, verse 4, that famous verse. Marriage, I'm reading from the New American Standard, the one Paul used. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. What's interesting is in the Greek, it only just says the bed. The bed is undefiled, but the context is about marriage, so it's right to interpret it that it's the marriage bed that's undefiled. Well, the Greek term for bed is the Greek term koite, K-O-I-T-E, which you do have in your notes there. And that's an antiquated term, coitus, but the term coitus for the sexual act, sexual intercourse, comes from this Greek word, koite. So this verse is saying not the bed, it means the sexual relationship in marriage is honorable. It's pure. The word that he uses there, undefiled, means it's without pollution of any kind in marriage. God made it that way. And so any other view of sex in marriage is a sinful view, an unbiblical view. And yet it is common to deal with people in a Christian marriage who have a sinful view of sex. It could be the wife struggling with the whole concept, could be the man as well, but it might be the wife who's struggling because all she's heard all of her life from her mother is, you know, nice girls don't do that. And maybe was never really taught the rest of the story, but nice girls do that in marriage. Perhaps her mother is the one that complained. It's all a boy wants. That's all a man wants. Maybe their parents, and I've talked to some couples that this is true, that their parents slept in separate bedrooms. By the way, you know, the sitcoms used to be that way. If you go back to the black and whites of I Love Lucy and stuff like that, there was a day that they wouldn't even show the married couple sleeping in the same bed together. They had twin beds, you know. Entertainment hasn't changed at all, right? It's still that same way today. You know, that's still consistent. Yeah, I've talked to people that, and they said, yeah, my mom and dad, they slept in separate bedrooms. And so for whatever reason, maybe she enters the marriage and there's problems in her sexual relationship with her husband. And so she doesn't want to talk about it. It's something dirty. Perhaps it's the husband that has a wrong view of sex. Maybe he's formed his view from all the locker room talk that he endured, you know, playing sports in school. I mean, if you came through a home school, you probably didn't endure that. But I remember... you know, playing sports teams and going to PE and being in the locker rooms and the bus rides to football games and basketball games. And I wouldn't even have any thought to want to tell you the kinds of things that were talked about and happened on those buses. It was terrible. So maybe a guy, maybe he's come to Christ, but he still has this wrong sort of view of what it's all about from that or movies he's seen or whatever. But the issue is the same. They're coming into marriage with a wrong view, not God's view about sex. And so when a person says they're embarrassed or uncomfortable talking about it, and I understand there's a level of decorum that we need to keep, But still, if they're that uncomfortable and it's something dirty or whatever, that's just learned behavior. It's not a biblical view. We've learned a sinful view of sex. That's not God's view. So a good question is, you have this in your notes, do you view sexual relations in marriage to be just as holy as these activities? Praying, reading the Bible, preaching, giving your offerings, teaching a Sunday school class. Well, yeah, those are holy activities, you know, God-honoring activities. Well, you need to add sexual relationships in marriage to that same list. Otherwise, we have an unbiblical view of sex, a sinful view of sex, because God calls it pure and honorable. Here's the second one, number two. Sex is not the basis of marriage. In other words, marriage is not first and foremost a physical union. You can say it more bluntly, marriage is not just legalized sex, okay? And Jesus settled that issue at the one with the well. You remember that story? I'm looking at my notes. Are yours all in black? Okay, good. I have a copy of what you have, but a bunch of it's in blue. Some blue and some black. Anyway, fallen world that we live in. But John chapter 4, okay, the Samaritan woman. You know, he gets in that conversation, interesting conversation, and somewhere in there he tells her that you've had five husbands. And then he says, and the man you're living with now is not your husband, okay? And somebody could say, well, yeah, I'm sure they were in separate bedrooms, right? No, they're living together. They're having sex. And so you glean from that. It's not the main point of the story, okay? It's not a story about sex, but there is an implication there that having sexual relationships with him in that story, that did not constitute a marriage. Jesus says to her, but you're not married to him. Marriage is more than that. And it doesn't matter whether the sexual activity is legal or illicit, it doesn't automatically produce marriage in God's eyes, nor does it automatically break the marriage in God's eyes. Not automatically if there's sexual relationship that's sinful. So in general, we would say a couple, syllabi are back there if you need them on the back, yeah. A couple is just as married after making that covenant public and being pronounced husband and wife. That's my favorite part of the ceremony. With all this power I have, I pronounce you, you know, husband and wife. They're just as married at that moment as they are after completion of their sexual relationship, you know, after the ceremony. So we can summarize this to say unity in marriage is more than sex. Sex alone is not what makes a marriage successful. Before sexual unity, there must be this other unity we've already discussed in here called companionship. That's essential to a good sexual relationship, is companionship, intimacy in the other areas of your marriage. So what I said at the beginning, the world's view and some Christians' view, you know, that, you know, a good sexual relationship is the basis for a good marriage, it's the opposite of that. A good marital relationship is the basis and the key to a good sexual relationship. Now, just to clarify one thing, I don't want you to conclude here, and the other points I think will verify this, but although sex is not the basis of marriage, it is very important. It is a very central part of marriage, a very important part of marriage. It is a very prominent part of marriage, and not to participate wholeheartedly and aggressively and passionately is sin, and it ought to be called that if you're going to take the biblical view. So the marriage partners should be enthusiastically involved in the riches of a God-designed biblical sexual relationship. You can say it this way, and I think it's in your notes. Passive sex is not biblical. Passive sex is selfishness. It says by action, your action, that God's word and your spouse are not important enough for you to put forth the effort. And I think that's a good way to say it, okay? It takes effort. It takes planning. It takes initiative and so forth. All right, so point number one was sex in marriage is pure and holy. That's the way God sees it. It's not the basis of a marriage, but it is very important. A good marriage is the key to a good sexual relationship. Number three, the primary goal, and this is very important. This is a new way of learning, though, depending on the world that you've grown up in. Primary goal, the sexual relationship, is giving. Now, when I say the purpose, the ultimate purpose I've already established is for the glory of God. Everything about marriage is for the glory of God, including sex and marriage. It's for the glory of God. But the practical goal underneath that big umbrella goal of the sexual activity itself is giving. And by giving, we mean it's the mindset of providing sexual satisfaction for your spouse. It is seeking to meet the needs of your spouse. It's an other focus. That's the goal and that's the purpose. So let's see how that's taught. We're going to be spending some time in 1 Corinthians 7 tonight, so you might as well turn there. We'll be camping out there a little bit, going back and forth, but we'll go into Proverbs in a moment and then come back to 1 Corinthians 7, so keep your finger there. You know 1 Corinthians 7, actually several places in 1 Corinthians, Paul is answering questions that they've written, and chapter 7 is no different. He begins it that way. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, how do we know that he's answering questions that they wrote? Because he said, now concerning the things about which you wrote. See how easy that was? There is some controversy over this next statement. What's the intent of the next statement? It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Is that what they wrote? Or is that what he's telling them? About the things you wrote, let me just cut to the chase. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. No, it's that first one. Okay, this is what they wrote. Why would they write that? Who were the Corinthians? What were they known for? Immorality. I've been there. I've been to the ruins of Corinth. And the mountain is still there, and you can see the ruins of the temple, the pagan temple there on the big mountain, where there were temple prostitutes, like thousands, and they would participate in orgies as part of their religious worship, and those prostitutes would filter down into the town as well. In that time, you've probably heard this preached before, but in that time of history, to Corinthianize meant to fornicate, okay, to be immoral. That's what they were known for. Well, Paul goes into that city, and if you remember that in Acts, he didn't think it was going to work out too well. He's about to leave, and God came to him in that vision. Remember, he said, hey, wait a minute, don't leave. I've got many people in this city. Go back. And so he went back in, began to preach the gospel, and some people got saved. A church was planted. My point is, these people got saved out of that kind of environment. So they come into marriage with wrong view about sex. And it is something dirty. And so some were concluding that, wow, that was all part of our pagan life. We can't do that anymore, you know. And they were depriving one another. And that will help you understand some of the language that's coming up. So he's speaking as we go through this. Keep in mind, and you'll see it, he's speaking both the husband and the wife. And he's going to give some principles that are same for each. Both have equal responsibility in this relationship. Look at verse 3. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Let's take that word fulfill. In the King James, it says render. Render due benevolence to your husband and your wife. It's a command. It's a command to give fully, completely, without reluctance, without inhibition, without hesitation, what is due your spouse. To put it another way, it's giving to meet the sexual needs of your mate, by their definition, by the way, enthusiastically and joyfully. So again, the goal is giving, not merely receiving. Make sure I didn't skip over something. Yeah. There's another word there, duty. You're fulfilling a duty. In the King James, it's benevolence, but it takes two words in the King James, due benevolence, okay? It's when we hear the word benevolence, what do we think of? What does that word mean?
Good deeds.
Yeah, good deeds. We even have a fund here. We call the benevolence fund. Sometimes we call it the deacon's fund. It's what we use. People give money to it. So if we need to help somebody in the church, you know, going through a hard time, whatever, we'll use money from the benevolence fund for that. You're doing good for somebody. So, it's a duty then, but it's with a duty with the idea of you're doing good for the other person, to the other person. You're giving the other person what they need. So marriage not only makes it legitimate, marriage makes this an obligation. So this is not saying that couples may come together in regular sexual activity. It's saying that they must come together. I mean, this really is what separates biblically a single person from a married person. A single person is commanded to be celibate. Married people are commanded not to be celibate, unless there's some physical problem. So the idea in duty then is of a debt. It's actually, this word is used elsewhere in Scripture to talk about a financial debt, money you owe somebody. So here it means that each spouse has a debt to pay, and each spouse is expected to pay up. Now the debt, we're not defining the debt a certain way tonight. We're, except in general terms, practical definition of what the debt is that's going to vary from couple to couple. They have to define that. They have to determine what is their norm. But in general, the debt is defined this way. It's meeting the needs of your spouse. So there's a duty to do good to the spouse, and it's the good that results from the sexual relationship. The husband is to satisfy her sexual desires, what they are, to meet her needs, to keep her sexually satisfied by her definition. And it's his duty, and it's for her benefit, and the husband's goal then is that, is giving to satisfy his wife, not just getting to satisfy self. Okay, so think of it in those terms. His goal, that's why we're calling it giving. His goal is not getting. His goal is not to be to satisfy self. His goal is to be, his mindset is to be, I want to satisfy my wife. Now that is the antithesis of what the world presents. That's the antithesis of TV, movies, literature, locker room talk, whatever. It's all about getting, how to use the other person to satisfy my needs. And the wife has the same command. She has the same responsibility. I said it was reciprocal. To sexually satisfy her husband completely, enthusiastically, and without reluctance. The primary goal of the sexual relationship for her is satisfying her husband. So sexual abstinence within a marriage is unbiblical. Again, unless there's something physical going on. And yet a lot of excuses are given for avoiding sex. And perhaps it's busyness. Perhaps it's the man who's saying, I'm just too busy in ministry, my job, too much going on, I've lost my interest. And so he's ignoring the needs of his wife. He has no desire, so she must have no desire either. He ignores her communication, problems result, or it's reverse. It's the busy, tired wife, busy, tired mother, busy, tired housewife. It doesn't matter which one it is. The issue is people allowing their personal desires to determine participation. And if one spouse wants to have sex more or less than the other, then what we're called upon each to do is to put their own needs aside and put the other person's needs above their own. Now that's taught, this idea of giving is even taught by the definition of love, the term agape. We said this when we did the role of the husband, to love your wife the way Christ loves the church. It's agape love. It doesn't say in John 3:16 that God so loved the world that he set up in heaven and he emoted fuzzy feelings for the world. No, he so loved the world that he gave. In agape love inherently is giving. And so sometimes the people ask, you know, does the Bible address pornography or other forms of selfish sexual activity? And the answer is yes. It addresses it, at least from this standpoint, because it's a very childish focus to focus on self. It's kind of funny that, or sadly funny, that adult movies are called adult when in reality it's built around selfishness, which is very childish, okay? It's a focus on self. If the goal is getting, then what happens is the person is never satisfied. And it's moving away from love, becoming more loving. And so it doesn't matter what form of self-gratification you discuss, there's something selfish that's going on. And it's a focus on getting. Even if you're giving in order to get, which can be very subtle, that's still selfish. And I think a lot have never really grasped this idea of sex. It is a game changer in some ways to have a mindset focused on the other person. And so what happens in marriage, a manipulation starts happening. It could be the husband who's selfish, and so he's trying to manipulate his wife to have sex. And some even think it's their role as a leader to demand it. And he has a right to demand it some way, and he's never told that in Scripture. Maybe even some books have told him that it's his right to demand that, and there are books out there that say that. Or it's manipulation by the wife, and she's trying to manipulate her husband with sex, and she'll let him have that when he pleases her in some other way. And so she uses it as a reward of some sort for pleasing her. Doesn't matter who's doing the manipulation or for what the reason is, but they've each lost the definition of what love is, that it's giving. Now, since the goal of sexual relations is satisfying the spouse, then and communicating love and providing pleasure for the mate, then the goal is not necessarily, ultimately, number one, personal physical pleasure. Now, don't get me wrong. I'll say this later. That's part of the blessing from the Lord. But the truth of the matter is a sexual encounter may or may not include that for one of the partners. So again, don't misunderstand. The wife or husband experiencing pleasure, that's not bad. I'll comment more on that. But for now, think of it this way. The physical pleasure involved, which is a blessing from the Lord, a wonderful gift from the Lord, it's not the first goal. Okay? Fulfilled duty is a different goal. It's focusing on the mate, not self. So the spouse is the one to determine if pleasure is even to be a part or not, or it's necessary. So we're not ignoring the reality that there is enjoyment. There's just a higher motivation. Well, what do you think the world would say to that kind of thinking? Okay? That's ridiculous. Okay? The reality is we have to relearn this. We have to train our minds to think differently. And someone might say, well, what do I get out of it then? What do I get out of this relationship? Well, what you get is the satisfaction of pleasing God by pleasing your mate. It's the joy of receiving physical pleasure as a byproduct of first being other-focused. And that's true both for the husband and the wife. And somebody could hear that and say, yeah, but I don't think that's my nature. Okay, I don't think I'm wired that way. And maybe that's true. But your nature is not to be your guide, okay, to your sexual relationship. God's word is. God gave us his word to help us know how to deal with our selfishness and any desires that are fleshly oriented. The Bible tells how to be pleasing to the Lord even when it's not my nature. Well, then that begs a question. How do I know then what pleases my spouse? Are you sitting down? Anybody want to take a guess? You got to communicate. Back to the C word, communicate. I have advised this before in counseling, and I just throw it out as a general. I didn't create this idea. I was told this some course I took years ago. But there have been times I've done this. Where a couple was struggling in this area. They're having conflict in this area. I'm trying to teach them a new way of thinking. Let's start over. Let's go about this the right way. And I'll assign a homework exercise that they each make a detailed list of the things they like and they don't like in their sexual activity. Okay, the things they enjoy, the things they don't enjoy. Each make that list separately. And then they give that list to me. No, I'm just kidding. They don't give that list to me at all, okay? I never see that list. What do you think they have to do with the list? What's the homework? Exchange it, okay? Now, somebody might hear that and go, okay, that's a practical thing to do. We can learn and talk about that thing, but you just told me not to focus on myself. And now you're saying it's okay to make a list of the things I like and don't like? Isn't that a focus on myself? And the answer to that is it depends on what you do with the information. And so here's the illustration that I was told in a seminary class years and years ago, you know, back in the dark ages when I went to seminary. Dr. Bob Smith, who mentored me in counseling, he told this story. He said, it's like this. Let me give you an example. Let's just say the wife and husband are talking on the phone, and the wife says, honey, what do you want for dinner tonight? And he says, well, I want a steak. Is he being selfish by answering her question? Well, we don't know yet. He gets home, and instead of fixing steak, she has fixed Wonder casserole with all the leftovers in the freezer from the past 6 months. You wonder what's in it. That's why it's called Wonder casserole. Mystery meat, perhaps. That's what she fixes. She didn't tell him what the meal would be, but he sits down expecting what? Steak. But no steak. His response at that time tells if the initial request was selfish. If he clams up, stops talking, gets silent for a day or two, gives her the cold shoulder. Why do they call it that? I always visualize like a chunk of ice on your shoulder and you're just, you know, giving it cold shoulder to somebody. Anyway, that's at one extreme, you know, anger, not talking, getting distant, silent. Something wrong, honey? No. Or the other extreme, he just blows up and calls it garbage and throws it, and I'm not going to eat this slop, you know. Well, then, his initial request of wanting steak was selfishly motivated. Now he's mad because he can't have what he wanted and what he expected. Surely you can make the bridge into the topic here, okay, that we're discussing tonight. On the other hand, if he does what all the husbands in this room would do, if he tells his wife how much he enjoys this food and how much he appreciates her efficient use of leftovers and just what a Proverb 30 woman she really is, you know, then his original request was not selfish. He's just giving her information that she requested that she could use. It would help her. But he's willing to accept her reasons for not fixing steak. He's willing to allow her to prepare steak another time. Again, the bridge is clear. The same is true for the sexual relationship. The goal is satisfying your spouse. Each should talk about this. Ask for a list. That can be helpful. And when the list is given, you give it with no expectations of anything on that list. Okay? And you're not disappointed if it doesn't happen. You give up the right, in a sense, to anything on the list. If you demand what you want, you become selfish. If you get angry and silent, you're selfish. If you're unkind to the other person by harshness, you're selfish. Listen, this happens in marriages over this issue of sex right here because of a lack of communication about it. They have different expectations. They're not communicating it. So the answer to all this is loving, open, biblical communication. That is essential to a good sexual relationship. I advise couples that it's not something they can talk about just one time, okay? A year into the marriage, let's have a little discussion about this, how we're doing. No, because your desires change. You get older. Life intervenes. You start having children. A lot of things change through the years. So I encourage couples to have, and I'm stealing this label from the government, to have a State of the Union address once a year, at least. A State of the Union discussion. How are we doing? Husbands, lead out in that. Let's talk about this. Because again, there's conflicts on this in marriage sometimes. And there's simmering anger over this. And they don't talk about it. Why? And so you have, many times, you've got a wife who's in counseling because the only time she experiences her husband's affection is when he wants sex. I mean, he's been a jerk for 2 or 3 days. And now he comes home and she's washing dishes and he comes up behind her and is kind of kissing her on the neck and how's your day gone? And hey, can I help wash the dishes? And she's going, what in the world? Oh, I know what he wants. Yeah. That's the only time he's like that, when he has a selfish goal of getting something. So it's not showing love and she sees the selfishness. Could be the husband thinking his wife is not satisfied unless he can define what the satisfaction is, unless it's what he wants her to be and do. And he's not, he needs to understand that there are times that she may be very satisfied by just being intimate with him and close to him, and that's it. And perhaps she'll have a desire for more another time. The point is, communication is very, 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 very important. Fourth implication. God has created both husband and wife with equal ability to satisfy each other. Yours might not have that many words in it, but that's the general point. They're each equal in this. In other words, the differences in anatomy and physiology are obviously complementary. And one, though, is not more important than the other in this relationship. Look at 1 Corinthians again, verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, the word authority there in the King James is the word power. It means control. It means independent control over your body. It means she, the wife, does not have entire authority over her body to use it for herself. There's somebody else in the picture, okay? Her focus is satisfying her husband. And so she has to view her body as an investment from the Lord that the God has given her, that she can invest in satisfying her husband. So the principle is for both. Each does not possess independent control of his or her own body. Neither the husband nor the wife has a right to demand or expect the other to use their body to satisfy him or her. In other words, each of their bodies was given to them to be used to satisfy their spouse. And so when we talk about a duty and something you owe the other person, say it the right way. It's not you owe me, it's I owe you. That's where the duty comes in. Not you owe me because of this verse. This verse 4 is not trying to give you ammunition to say, read this verse. You don't own your body, I do. No, it's still giving. This verse is reminding me that I owe you something, okay? So the emphasis is not on possessing the body of the other, not possessing it, owning it, but on the fact that I do not have entire authority over my body to do with it as I please. So this is all about a husband and wife giving themselves freely to one another. It's not about insisting on your authority. It's about being a servant to your spouse. And once again, both husband and wife have the same command. The wife, therefore, is to be aggressive in the sexual relationship. She must see that her body is given to her to meet the needs of her husband, and she should be in aggressive in doing that. Some wives hear that and think it's taking over leadership. There was a book that came out many years ago when Pam and I first married. It's written by a Catholic woman, if I remember. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible book. And it was telling women, stop doing things to try to please your husband. Stop dressing a certain way. Stop wearing a certain perfume that he likes, you know, so on and so forth. You know, sex is about one thing, having children, that's it. Okay, it's not about pleasure. This was a so-called Christian woman. I don't think she was, but and a lot of women bought into that. Well, that's not the biblical view. Okay, it's again, that's insisting something on authority over your body. It's fine for the wife to be aggressive in this and to see that she has a responsibility in this to make this happen in their relationship. Some wives would think that that's taking over the husband's leadership. They've heard this thing that the husband's the leader, the wife is only a responder. That's not really true. It may flesh out that way in many ways, but the wife is not taking over the husband's leadership role in the sexual relationship here and violating Scripture if she's also being aggressive. And just think about it. I mean, there are many other areas in your normal week and how you go about your home life where the wife may be aggressive and without any problems at all. And so I don't know how you divide up the duties in your home, but let's just take a very stereotypical approach that the wife is very aggressive in preparing meals and buying groceries and determining what we're going to eat for dinner and whatever, and she aggressively fulfills those responsibilities in her life. I mean, my wife doesn't come to me on Sunday night, you know, when she's been working on the menu all day, and she bows down in front of me and, you know, submits the menu for the list. Are these okay, honey? Can we have these? I mean, I find out when I sit down, you know, and take the, you know, see if there's a pheasant under the glass, you know, or something. Most of the time, that's what happens. There's a lot of responsibilities the wife is aggressive in around the home, the children, all those things. And so, and a lot of those are not even specifically as spelled out in Scripture as this one. So I would still maintain she must be as aggressive in in meeting the needs of her husband sexually as she is in those other areas. That's her responsibility. So a wife that's not seeing it that way ends up potentially then being selfishly motivated. It's irresponsible for her husband to wait for her husband to tell her all of her responsibilities to do. Like Dr. Smith used to say, you know, the wife should be, he should be so satisfied that he doesn't even need to ask, you know. Use the list. The point now is there's no difference in either one in their ability to use their body on behalf of the other. The husband does not have the greater ability. He cannot just be called the aggressor. The wife doesn't have the lesser ability, so she's the responder. Now, let's get practical. What about just the reality of different levels of desire? Is that a reality? Sure it is. That's typical. It's normal. We don't know why all the difference of levels of desire are there. It could be the difference between men and women. It could be just the difference in how you're wired. I've talked to some couples that are not, I mean a handful, that are not stereotypical at all. It's the wife that was sexually aggressive, sexually interested in the husband, not so much. And so that was probably not typical, you know, most that I talked to. But what about different levels of desire? Did it come just from because of learning? Any level of desire can be relearned, can be taught. But what if it's not that? What if it's just the way I'm made? That's a good question. If that's true, the issue is still not the level of desire, but it's what does God's Word say? What is my responsibility before the Lord? What's the goal? It's giving. Why did God give me my body and so forth? So the problem ultimately is not how people are made, but their willingness to just obey the Lord. Otherwise, we're hiding behind these kind of things, and that ends up being rebellion. It's insisting on authority over my body that I don't have. So I would say that neither can be passive, neither should be passive. Selfishness and bargaining, that's all sin. So just to summarize this whole point, you have it in your notes, sexual relations are to be equal and reciprocal. To get practical about that, mutual initiation of intercourse, mutual foreplay, mutual participation in the sexual act, I would say it's not just permitted, I would say it's commanded. Demanding is forbidden. And if you become upset because your request was not fulfilled, then that was a demand, it was not a request because your focus is on yourself. Well, beat that dead horse enough. Number five, pleasure in sex is not sinful or forbidden. It actually is assured and encouraged. There's nothing wrong with enjoyment of the physical pleasure in sex. The problem is that because we're sinners, we often pursue sex for the pleasure alone, quite apart from the other things that God has ordained and said. But that doesn't mean that pleasure is the problem. It's a blessing of the Lord. I think Scripture is actually clear that the pleasure of sex is a good gift from God. And so God's not adverse to pleasure. Certainly in 2 Timothy, I think it is, there are those who make an idol out of pleasure. They love pleasure more than they love God, you know, that kind of thing. They make an idol out of it. But when the pleasure of sex is enjoyed in keeping with God's comprehensive directions and purposes, then it glorifies God. Just read the Song of Solomon correctly, okay? Read the Song of Solomon correctly, and it gives you vivid descriptions of the pleasures of marital love. Also, I quote John Murray here. I mean, you know, one of the great greats from the past. His classic book called Principles of Conduct. John Murray, way back, said this, sexual desire is not wrong. It is not wrong to desire to satisfy sex desire and impulse in the way God has ordained. Indeed, sexual desire is one of the considerations which induce men and women to marry. The Scripture commends marriage as the honorable and necessary outlet for your God-given sexual desires. So pleasure, delight, definitely a part, but a byproduct of obeying all this from the Lord. Now hold your finger there in 1 Corinthians 7, go to Proverbs 5. I'm going fast because I'm watching that clock. I'm wearing a watch today. I hadn't worn a watch in years. Had to take it to a place and have a battery put in so I could wear it. Proverbs 5, verses 18 and 19. This is in the context where Solomon is writing to his son to avoid sexual sin, immorality, all of that. But he says some interesting things here. Look at verse 18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. So the first seven chapters here are actually full of repeated warnings against sexual sin, sex outside of marriage. Chapter 5 begins with that, but in the center, this beauty and delight of marriage is described. But look what it says first. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. That's saying, start there. Delight in her as a person. Now, he's writing to his son. If he'd written to a daughter, you know, the pronouns would be reversed and all that. It goes both ways. But delight in her as a person. See her as a loving hind and a graceful doe. A hind was a small animal, okay, like a doe, small deer. Yeah, either way, they're graceful, beautiful, affectionate animals. And so by calling your wife that, seeing her that way, it's a picture of the pleasantness of your spouse. We've already taught this in here. She's your best friend. So it implies a desire for her companionship first, more than just as a sexual partner. So that's why we have to develop an intimate relationship on all other levels besides the physical first. So delight in her as a person. But it does go on to say, to delight in the sexual relationship. The use of the term breast there obviously signifies sexual relationship. So he's also saying her sexuality. Sexuality is a source of satisfaction for you. And once again, it's restricted to marriage. Verse 8 says, it's your wife. Her breast, her love, verse 19. God-blessed, real sexual delight can only be found this way in marriage. Be only satisfied with your mate. That's what he's saying. All attempts to find it elsewhere are unsuccessful, whether it's in thought or deed. You have some verses you can look up, the commitments that we have to make with our eyes and our minds and so forth. But look at the word satisfy. Let's look at some of the language there. The word satisfy in the Hebrew there, what verse is that? Let her breast satisfy you at all times. The word satisfy is the word they would use for the picture of a thirsty person being quenched with a cool drink of water, like the old Westerns. You know the old Westerns? A guy gets on a horse, and he's got to go across this desert, and the sun's beating down, and the mountain's like 100 miles over there. And so he starts off riding the horse, and he's got a canteen. He takes a swig here and there. It's getting hotter and hotter. Eventually, he takes the last drops out of the canteen. You know, there's so many Westerns were like this. He throws the canteen over. At some point, now he can't even ride the horse. He's pulling the horse. You know, he's leading the horse. And then finally, the horse falls over, you know, because the horse doesn't know why. So he has to shoot the horse. And then he starts to see a mirage, you know, and he runs up there, and he's throwing sand in his face, you know, and it's just sand. It's not water. And he passes out. I don't know how, but somebody always finds him, okay? I don't know how that works. An Indian or something. And they come up and they show it. His face is burnt to a crisp and his lips are cracked. And they start giving him a little water and he's taking it in. My point is, that's what this word means. It's conjuring up something refreshing, something delightful, something pleasant. And so in the context of talking about sex, his or her desire is completely satisfied. The sexual relationship is to be viewed this way as something refreshing, delightful, satisfying, as pleasant as a drink of water out in the desert. So there's nothing here about being passive, about passively offering up your body. This is about aggressively using your body to bring sexual satisfaction to your spouse. And it's not something you receive. The mindset is something you give first. The word exhilarated is a great word. Be exhilarated always with her love. King James is a great word. Anybody know what the word is there in King James? Ravished, you know, be ravished. You know what the word means literally? Get drunk, be intoxicated. This is the one place in the Bible where you're told it's okay to get drunk. Be so drunk and intoxicated that you're overwhelmed with satisfaction, intoxicated by it, completely satisfied. You've been so aggressively pleasing your spouse that he or she just can't receive anymore. Okay? Satisfied to the point of being overwhelmed. I throw it in again. It's based on your mate's evaluation of pleasure received, not your definition. You put this with 1 Corinthians 7. Let's go back to that. Put it with 1 Corinthians 7. You get the picture. Each is to provide this kind of refreshment, this kind of satisfaction for the other. Make sure your spouse is drunk, intoxicated. The responsibility is not a drudgery. It's not to be seen that way. It's delightfully pleasant when you view it the way God does. So how do you know when you followed 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3 and 4? Well, in one sense, it's your spouse is so satiated it would be difficult to be tempted in the thought life or by action, and it's to be viewed as a delightful task. Number 6, sexual relations are to be continuous. This is the last one. Regular and continuous. 1 Corinthians 7, 5. Stop depriving one another. Now that tells us it's in the present tense command, and a present tense command in the Greek means it has been going on, so stop it. Okay, like that internet thing, stop it. That's Bob Newhart. Oh, classic. If you haven't seen it, look it up. Bob Newhart, stop it. Go watch that. 1 Corinthians 7, 5. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of control. Let's look at a few words. Depriving. The word deprive means to keep something back by deceitful methods. It's failing to fulfill your duty, but you're failing for selfish reasons. Well, I'm too tired. I have a headache. Got a big day tomorrow. Got a lot to do tonight. Big games on tonight. When those aren't the real reasons, that's the point. I mean, if you have a headache, say that. A loving spouse should be sensitive to that. Of course, those are real reasons. But saying you have a headache when the real reason is you're mad at him, that's something different. That's depriving. Avoiding sex becomes more important than satisfying the spouse. It becomes a way of getting back at him for something he did do or something he didn't do. It's a payback for a hurt. Personal desire is more important than satisfying spouse and pleasing God. So again, this is not saying don't be honest. I mean, that's the real world. Say so if you're not interested. Say so if you're tired and you really do have a headache. Again, a loving partner needs to be sensitive and to listen and not generate conflict because there's anger. But there are some guidelines now for abstaining from sex. Okay? So with everything I've said, what about some guidelines when maybe abstinence is necessary? Okay, I'm gonna give them to you. There's four. In verse 5, I need to define abstinence, by the way. Abstinence is defined by getting out of your norm, whatever that is. It doesn't matter what the norm is for another couple. It doesn't matter what the norm is based on TV and movies and things like that, the world's perspective. Every couple settles into some norm, that this is their pattern, okay? When it comes to frequency, activity, whatever. So what we're talking about is getting out of your norm. Here are the guidelines. Number one, it says in verse 5, except for agreement. So the first guideline is both agree. You have that in your notes. Both agree. In other words, there's mutual consent. There's an understanding on both sides. Well, obviously we understand this is not a good time. A lot of stuff going on. There's sickness, illness, you know, whatever. My wife is in an accident. She's in a coma and a complete body cast for a year. Oh, yeah, I remember now. We got out of our norm. I'm probably going to get you out of your norm if that happens. Although, maybe I said this earlier, I counseled a couple of years ago in another state, an unnamed state where I used to live, and they were upper middle age, been married for many years. In 20 years, they'd been married 20 years, and they had had sex 5 times in 20 years. Okay, I can guarantee you that's not normal. Okay, and so there was a lot of discussion there about why that was true for them, and the Lord did a wonderful work in their marriage. Anyway, there's an agreement here. Number two, it says, for a time. In other words, there's some specific period of time that's understood. It's even prearranged. It's predetermined. We understand that right now, here's what's going on, but maybe next, you know, whatever. And so you agree to that. You both understand it. And then it does confirm that it's for some reason. There's a specific reason. Now, we need to understand this verse correctly. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. That almost makes it sound like, is he about to tell us that we need to either be having sex or praying, those two things, all the time in our marriage, okay? I mean, it sort of looks that way. Let me tell you why we think that way. What does the Bible tell us to pray about?
Everything.
In everything. Pray. Pray always, without ceasing. We just kind of forget that. People are tired, you're busy, pray. It's a matter for prayer. One of you's sick, that's a matter for prayer. Problems going on in your children, you're both burdened about, or one of you just gets a call and you thought things were planned that night and suddenly a call comes in and it's terrible news, something's happened in your family, extended family, it's been a death in the family, whatever. It's a matter of prayer. I think we have a hard time understanding his point here because we don't pray like we should. So I think broaden your understanding. It could be anything. It could be a trip. One of you's on a business trip. It gets you out of your norm. One of you's sick for a while. A lot of things going on. Every issue in life should be a spiritual issue. We should pray about everything. But number four, you do understand we're going to come back together again. This abstinence is going to be terminated by sexual relations again, okay? So when you're refraining, or you've gotten out of your norm, or your expectations on frequency are not being met in some way, you need to communicate about it, but what's going on? Talk about it so you can both agree. I tell you what, it takes, especially young husbands have to learn this, of what it means to be mature about this and to be patient and to be understanding and loving. Otherwise, they're making an idol out of their sexual relationship, and that happens a lot, with men especially. My point is, a couple knows through communication what's normal for them and what's considered, not what's considered normal for others, and based on that, when they choose to refrain, these reasons are there somehow, and they understand that. So the question comes up, then, what is the right frequency of sex? Well, I'm not going to give you a number. Luther did. He actually taught. Forgot what his guideline was. He had it was some number per week. Okay, and that's what he taught his students. You know, so I'm not going to do that. Just going to say this: enough to satisfy each other and to meet needs. That's how often. So that there's no burning and unfulfilled desire. He talks about that in verse 9. But it's by your mate's definition, not yours, imposed on them, and that's where it goes wrong. Enough to avoid temptations. How continuous is Satan's temptation? Well, it's all the time. So unnecessary abstinence in sex makes self-control more difficult. Self-control is still required in marriage. I think a lot of single men don't understand that. One of our pastors in our seminary network told this story years ago because he pastored college students and he was constantly having coffees and breakfasts and stuff like that with young college students, young men. Every time he got a call from a young man, he knew what it was going to be about. Struggling with lust, so forth. But he said something funny one time. He said he was at breakfast with this one guy, and he said, at the end of encouraging him and giving him some Bible verses, think about how to exercise self-control. And the single guy looked at this pastor and said, "Man, what's it like to have sex every day?" And the pastor said, "I have no idea." But that was his mindset. It's like, okay, marriage, that's the answer, right? No more have to exercise self-control, right? No. Still have to do that. All right. So you get the point of all that. Let me give you some disclaimers here for a moment. You have this in your notes. Caution. Do you have that? Nothing I've said was intended to remove the principle of consideration for each other. Okay, don't throw that out the window. Patient, loving, considerate, compromise, all of that is necessary. Understanding where the other person is at and not insisting on something. That's just love and graciousness. Nothing I've said is meant to excuse unreasonable demands, okay? So yes, I believe in aggressiveness on both parts. I believe this is an important part of marriage. We shouldn't say it's not. I don't want to say things inappropriately in a pulpit setting, you know, but certainly there are times for saying things more bluntly in a class, or even more bluntly sometimes counseling with people to answer questions. But in your conclusion, then I'll bring up some miscellaneous issues, and then I'll answer questions if I can. A good marital relationship is the basis and the key to a good sexual relationship. If you just take one point out of tonight, it's that. Let me address just a couple of miscellaneous issues. One is Romans 14 has an application to this. Romans 14 is the chapter that deals with conscience issues, right? Okay. How do you make decisions based upon your conscience? What if your conscience is different from another believer's conscience? And so Paul is addressing that in the church at Rome, but he's dealing with the church at large, and some would eat vegetables only, and some ate everything, you know, that moved or didn't move. And so there was disagreement in the church over those things. They had different preferences, even some different convictions, and Paul is telling them, but if you're each doing it before the Lord, you have to allow that. And so in a church like ours, certainly we have different viewpoints on certain social things, entertainment things, food and drink, and all of that. And so we have to allow that. He mentions another one, that some people in the church, you know, only one day of the week is holy, and the others were going, oh, every day is holy. We can worship on any day. Doesn't matter. And so Paul outlines this idea that if he calls them the strong brother and the weak brother, and I know I've preached on it before, and I'll preach on it again. It's coming up in Romans 14, which is what, a couple months from now? And he calls the person a strong of faith if they can go either way on an issue. You can take it or leave it. You can do it or you cannot do it. Doesn't matter. That's called the strong in faith. The weak in faith on any issue is the one who says it must be a certain way. You must not eat this, you must not drink this, or you must eat it or you must drink it. Either side of it, you're called the weak in faith. Paul himself classifies himself as the strong in faith. On food, entertainment, he mentions one more in there. He mentions food, day of the week. Later he mentions wine in that chapter. Okay? But take those out. Read the chapter. Plug in other things. Plug in music. Plug in drums in the church. Okay? How about that, Justin? Can we have drums in the church? I know Proverbs says that the fear of man brings a snare. But other than that, little humor there, very little. You'll get it later. People ask me, what about music in the church? Does the Bible talk about that? Yeah, Romans 14. Does the Bible talk about medical issues and birth control and things like that? Yeah, Romans 14. Does the Bible talk about certain activities in your sexual relationship? And I get asked that question. What about this? Is it okay if a Christian does such and such? Does the Bible answer that? I go, yeah, it does, Romans 14. Okay. So it's a very important chapter on this. So it applies to this because there can be different conscience levels on things in this area of your relationship. You might not be the same is what I'm trying to say. And so some of the principles that come out in Romans 14 is for you personally, if you have a conscience issue against something, you must not violate your conscience. Even if the Bible hadn't said it overtly that this is sin, but if it bothers your conscience and you go against your conscience, you have sinned against God. You must not do that. For the other person, you must never make your spouse violate their conscience in any way. Never demand or ask something that's a conscience issue for your spouse. Be sensitive to that, okay? That's how you answer all the questions that come up. Well, what about this? What about that? What about this? Okay? Number two. Practically, these are no particular order. Practically speaking, many times in counseling, we've counseled couples, look, you may have to be very intentional about this. If you're struggling over this, first of all, communicate about it. But if you're struggling in finding the time and everything else, and the more kids you have, the worse it gets, you know. So whether it's your communication time or whether it's your sexual time or whatever, there can be benefit in sitting down together and scheduling it. It's like, well, where's the romance in that? You know, everything's supposed to be spur of the moment and just comes upon us and we can't control ourselves. Yeah, throw all that out. There may be some moments like that, but by and large, there's the romance of anticipation because, you know, we both agreed that this is when we're going to be together. Schedule it. Put it on your calendar. Don't anybody else see your calendar. Use code or something, you know. Third, I get questions about birth control. So back to Romans 14. What do we teach about that? Well, we teach that if something is overtly abortive, then that one's out, okay? So I don't know. They seem to have changed some of the ones that were around when I was in pharmacy school and sold and stuff like that, you know, and what was available back in those days. Even some of those forms have changed. And so I don't know all the details of what's designed to be abortive, but there are some birth control methods that's how they do it. I mean, the morning after pill, for example, is a high level of progesterone, is what I'm thinking, must be. And so if progesterone gets to a certain level, then that's going to make it inside the uterus a hostile environment where a fertilized egg can't implant. And so it's designed to be abortive, okay? So it's out for the Christian, okay? So do your research. Back in the day, there were, maybe still today, but I don't know all the forms of birth control pills today, but we don't take a stand on this except the ones that are overtly abortive. Back in the day when I was a pharmacist, there was controversy for some Christians on whether a Christian could take a birth control pill or not. But birth control pills back in that day, I don't study them today, were a combination of estrogen and progesterone, okay? Both are, especially the estrogen, is designed to stop ovulation, okay? So your what's that thing called? Ovary, thank you. Been out of school too long. Your ovary produces an egg, and it's really amazing. I mean, normally I think it's this ovary produces an egg 1 month, and the next month the other ovary produces egg. If you have one ovary removed, the other ovary then produces an egg every month. I mean, isn't it amazing, considering we all evolved from slime? I mean, it's just incredible. Obviously, I don't believe that. But anyway, estrogen prohibits ovulation. It's not 100% effective, okay? People do get pregnant on birth control pills. The progesterone is not at a level in those birth control pills to be abortive. It has a different mechanism of action. So the idea that a birth control pill is automatically out for a Christian, that's not really true, even medically. And in fact, I was talking to an OB-GYN chief of medicine, a guy out in California one time, and he was saying, and when you get pregnant, I mean, hormones change in your body already. It's a moot point about that birth control pill. Anyway, you have to determine what your conscience is on that. And so we don't enter in on that. That's up to a couple to decide. Our only counsel is you better be in agreement on it. And I had to counsel someone one time, a couple where they never talked about this before they got married. They didn't talk about it in marriage. And several years into the marriage, they didn't have the same viewpoint on birth control pill. On birth control, it wasn't birth control pill, just birth control. Which is a misnomer anyway, it's really conception control. That's really what it should be called, but that's not gonna catch on in the culture. So it's like, wow. And they were on opposite sides on something. And that was hard to work through. Yeah, you need to be on the same page, that's the main thing. If you need to talk through that with somebody, then sit down and talk through somebody. But you've got to make that conscious decision before the Lord. We as a church do not legislate that. Unless it's absolutely proven it's designed to be abortive in nature, then it's out. All right, I've gone fast, left out a bunch of things. I've left 1 minute for questions. Anything I need to clarify or whatever? It's a hard topic to ask questions about. I get that, okay. You can email me. I'm trying to think, is there anything else I should say?
Where do you find so much pheasant?
So much what?
Pheasant.
Pheasant? Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know where she kills them. She goes out hunting and she hunts pheasant and comes back in. And she's a Proverbs 31 woman, you know. Yeah, no. Our pheasant under glass will be half of a hamburger patty, you know. Okay. A salmon patty that we've heated up. Okay. Yeah, it's code for something else. Yeah. All right. Well, wow. I'm not letting you out. You got 30 more seconds. Anything else you need to clarify?
I'll tell you something not necessarily related to the
to pheasants?
Topic.
Oh, and, okay.
When you go back to Romans 14, I'm a little puzzled by something. That is that you say that the person of faith doesn't care one way or the other.
Yeah. Strong in faith. Yeah, it doesn't care either way. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a particular terminology only in Romans 14. He's not talking about how strong your faith is in the gospel. It doesn't matter. It's not saying that your gospel faith is stronger than another gospel's faith. He's specifically applying that terminology, which is confusing, to the implications of understanding that I'm justified by faith alone. If I'm justified by faith alone and not by my performance, then you run with the implications of that. Then there's a lot of things then that I don't have to worry about because I'm justified by faith alone. So the person who really understands that then comes back to an issue like whether I can eat pork or bacon or meat that's been offered to an idol, like in their day. The strong in faith would say, yeah, it's fine. Eat it, not eat it, because this does not determine my relationship with the Lord. My salvation is secure whether I eat this meat or not. So if it's a good deal, eat it. If it's not a good deal, well, that's up to you, you know. The weak in faith has to have it a certain way. You must eat it or you must not eat it. I'll give you an example, modern day example. Now, I'm trying to be hypothetical. Let's take something like, I don't know, vaccines, something really hypothetical like vaccines. Here we go. Oh, we're out of time. The strong in faith is the one that says, take it or not take it, doesn't matter. You want to get the COVID vaccine, doesn't matter. It's up to you. The weak in faith, both sides are weak in faith. The ones who were saying, oh, I've done the research. You cannot do that. You must not, Christians must not take that vaccine. Automatically, that chapter says they're the weak in faith. Or the ones who are saying, we've got to protect the people. We've got to be responsible. We've got to do this. It's our role before the Lord to get this vaccine. They're weak in faith. The strong in faith says, do what your conscience is before the Lord. It's fine. Yeah. I don't know if that helps, but that's what he's talking about.
Well, yeah, that much I get. I mm-hmm. guess I think about more specific things. Like, for example, we're commanded to pray.
Okay, that's different. If there's a command to do or not to do, totally different category discussion. Romans 14 is dealing with what we call the gray areas of life. Neither black nor white is what we mean.
Yeah. You know, whatsoever is not of faith is sin, but that's kind of...
Yeah, and that's what it's talking about. I give an example because it was a real example years ago. A young woman grew up being taught that wearing lipstick was wrong for a Christian girl to do. That was the religion they were in, the particular sect that they were in is what I would call it. And all her life she was taught that. So they didn't wear pants, they didn't do their hair, they didn't wear makeup. But when she was like 18 or something, you know, she had a job and she had some girlfriends there, some friends she met, you know, and she knew she was different. But they kept, you know, saying, oh, you'd look so pretty with this. Oh, with some eyeshadow, you'd be this. Oh, where? She goes over to their house one night and she gives in and she puts on lipstick. And she goes home just devastated that I've done this. And the next morning she's calling the pastor. I got to meet. She comes in and she says, I sinned. I wore lipstick. The pastor's wrong if he says, you didn't sin. The Bible doesn't say it's wrong to wear lipstick. She did sin. She sinned against her conscience, even though her conscience was wrong. If your conscience, even if it's wrong, says that this would be wrong for you to do, and you go ahead and do it anyway, the dynamic in your heart that's driving you to do that is the same dynamic that drives you to not pray when you're told to pray. Same heart dynamic. So he has to counsel her to confess that to the Lord. You sin by wearing lipstick. Get that off your conscience. Confess to the Lord. Repent of that. Then he wants to retrain her conscience over time to come to understand that really is not a sin an issue. And so, yes, that's a far-reaching verse. Whatever is not of faith is sin. On the things the Bible hasn't come out and said is overtly wrong or overtly right. And what's amazing is how many things are on that list.